From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. They are not a dime a dozen. People willing to give up a lot, houses, vacations, meals out, family, time and ties, sometimes almost everything, to be able to give more to others, serious do-gooders. They can inspire us. They can make us uncomfortable. Their altruism can seem over the top. New Yorker writer Larissa McFarquhar wishes there were a better term for them, but do-gooders it is. She's collected their stories and dived into the literature, philosophy, and social science on extreme giving and devotion to a moral cause. This hour on Point, Larissa McFarquhar on impossible idealism, drastic choices, and the overpowering urge to help. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Do we need more people like this? When do we admire them, emulate them? When and why do we turn away? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Some in the broad category, very famous. Mother Teresa, here in 1974 with Irish Television. Mother Teresa describing her first contact with a dying person in Calcutta.
I picked up the first person from the street, and I found a woman lying in the street, eaten up by rats and so on. And I took her to the nearest hospital, and they didn't seem to want her there. But because I insisted so much, at last they took her in. Then from there I decided that I will find a place for them myself and take care of them.
Mother Teresa, they don't get much more famous than that, but there are plenty who are not famous. Here from Larissa's book, Suba Doe and her husband Hector. They're the parents of 22 children, only two of them their biological children. All those adoptions. She talks about her experience here from her website.
Every child needs a family that's going to be theirs forever, for a lifetime. Every person, in fact, regardless of age, needs a family not only to grow up in, but to grow old in. A family that's going to be with you no matter what.
And she and her husband have adopted 20. Joining me now from New York is Larissa McFarquhar, staff writer at The New Yorker, and author of the new book, Strangers Drowning, Grappling with Impossible Idealism, Drastic Choices, and the Overpowering Urge to Help. You can read an excerpt from the book at our website, onpointradio.org. Larissa, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me on, Tom.
You say right off the top you don't really like the term do-gooders, but you haven't found a better one. What's the paucity of language, or why did you end up with this one, do-gooders?
Well, the usefulness of do-gooder is that it captures our ambivalence towards this type of person. If you say we have uncomfortable feelings towards people who do good deeds, people might say, no, we don't. What are you talking about?
Right.
But if you say do-gooder, immediately people know what you mean. And it captures this whole set of feelings that I wanted to investigate in this book. I mean, on the one hand, we've been told that these people are kind of twisted, maybe even narcissistic. There's something wrong with them. On the other hand, there's also a cliche out there that they're kind of simple and boring. You know, at one point I talked to a novelist and asked him, why don't you novelists write more about such people? And he gave me this look like I'd asked him, you know, why don't you write a nice book about bunnies and butterflies? And I thought, that's what I have to combat. I have to explain the complexity and the beauty of these lives.
You're not really focused on every kind of do-gooder. I mean, it's a very broad term, but there's some sorts of do-gooders that really aren't your focus. You say it can mean a silly or intrusive person who tries to do good but ends up only meddling. It can mean someone who seems annoyingly earnest or priggish or self-righteous or judgmental. Are you avoiding those kinds of do-gooders, or are there elements of that even in the people who you write fully and richly but admiringly about?
Well, I wanted to write about people I wholeheartedly admired because I'm sure there are do-gooders out there who are incredibly aggravating, and I didn't want to write about them because they are not challenging. They're too easily dismissed. So the people I wrote about, I really liked in addition to admiring them. And they're not self-righteous because they think what they're doing is just their duty. In fact, they are puzzled why other people don't do similar things. I mean, they're not idiots. They know that they're unusual and that people aren't doing what they're doing. But they're not self-righteous because they don't feel like they're doing more than they ought to. Just like, you know, if you went to a store and you left without stealing a single thing, you wouldn't really pat yourself on the back. And that's how they feel about it. But they are judgmental because they do feel that we all should be doing more. And the difference is, though, that they're not judgmental out of a sense of superiority, because if they felt they were better than everybody else, then there would be no cause to judge other people for not doing what they do, but they don't. They feel that they're just ordinary people like the rest of us, and so why don't other people do more?
I mean, there's where this becomes so catching, because I think a lot of us, we look around at what's going on, the fears of climate change and all the rest, and think we should be doing more, and yet very few of us relatively dive into the kind of commitment that the people you profile here do. We're going to hear some great stories, but could you define then, if it's not just the meddling or priggish or, you know, all those sort of demeaning faces of the term do-gooder, define the do-gooders you were looking for and you found, Larissa.
Yeah, there's sort of two there are many ways in which they differ from the rest of us, but there's two main ways. One is, I would say that, you know, most of us, if we saw someone in need right in front of us, if someone fell in the street or was taken sick, or, you know, if we saw a photograph like that picture of that toddler drowning in Europe mm-hmm. recently that the whole world saw and felt strong emotions about, then we're moved to help. But the difference is that these kinds of people don't need to see it right in front of them. They don't need a photograph. They know, as we all know intellectually, that there are people in need of help all the time, all over the place. And that moves them as much as seeing someone in need helps moves the rest of us. It's almost an aesthetic quality in them. It's a kind of vividness of imagination that they can picture the suffering of people halfway across the world who they've never met and know very little about in the way that we can picture something right in front of us. And then the other difference between them mm-hmm. and the rest of us is I feel like most of us want to give everything we possibly can to our families. That is not only what we want to do, but it's also what we feel we ought to do. That's the right thing. And these people also love their families as much as anybody else, but that's not what they feel. They don't feel that that's the only thing they have to do in life. They also have to care for strangers. And sometimes they care for strangers so much that it conflicts with caring for their family. It bites into their time, their attention, their money. It cuts into their family life in a way that most of us would find a step too far.
You put them in a different category, though. You talk about Gandhi and you talk about Mother Teresa, but you're sort of carving those out as different from your focus. How so, Larissa?
Well, you know, the famous do-gooders that we all know about, like Gandhi and Mother Teresa, they come to our attention because they have another kind of genius unrelated to their altruism, which is they're entrepreneurs or they're, in Gandhi's case, a political genius. They mm-hmm. found things, movements or institutions that are successful and last beyond their lifetimes. I wanted to separate the urge to do good from those other kinds of genius of entrepreneurialism. And so I wanted to focus on people who were not famous, who were simply driven to help as much as possible, even if what they did not extend beyond their own lives. So you mentioned earlier mm-hmm. Sue and Hector Badeau, who adopted 20 children. Their form of doing good is in their own family. Sue is also an adoption advocate, but mainly her focus is those 20 children who did not have parents and were really unlikely to get them. I mean, for instance, they adopted 6 teenagers who were brothers and sisters, and they adopted them because they thought nobody else is going to adopt 6 teenagers and keep them together. They'll either get separated into different families or they'll never have parents at all. So their focus was those 20 kids who were initially strangers to them, but they brought them into their family and made them part of their lives.
Now, Hector grew up in a family, I think, of 16 children, so he was used to big families still.
Exactly,
But when people looked at them, they had 2 of their own kids, they adopted 20 more. Did friends and neighbors think, that is so marvelous, Sue and Hector, or did they think, these guys are crazy?
Oh, both. Definitely people were whispering about them, thinking, they're nuts. Why would they do this? And even if they understood the sense of duty, they thought, this is actually wrong. They're presumptuous to think they can be good parents to so many kids. And again, I think the way that ordinary people think about the idea of adoption is, I'm going to adopt 1 or 2 or maybe 3 kids and give them everything I have, just like I do my biological kids if I have them. And I'm going to try and my hardest to give them a conventional, successful life. I want them to go to college. I want them to get married, et cetera. And Sue and Hector wanted those same things for their kids. But instead of thinking it's better for us to concentrate on our four kids. Their initial plan was to have two and adopt two.
Yeah.
So the initial plan was for four. They couldn't stop thinking about the other children out there who were still strangers to them. And when other people say, well, if you'd adopted fewer, those fewer would have done better, I don't know if that's true or not, but even if it were true, they wouldn't stop thinking about, well, what about the other 18? What about those other 18 kids who we didn't adopt and who therefore went through life without parents? Their lives would unquestionably have been much worse. These were kids coming from horrible, horrible backgrounds. So they don't think of it as, I'm going to give everything I have to a few. They want to bring in more and more as long as they're making those new kids' lives better.
We're going to hear some amazing stories from Larissa McFarquhar, but I'm curious about your goal here. Are you trying to get the rest of us to up our game, up our altruism, or just explore our ambivalence about what you call do-gooders? What's your goal with the book?
Well, as I said, I mean, I wanted to convey to people that these lives are beautiful and grand and extraordinary. They're not these miserable, twisted up, narcissistic lives that I think cliches have fed us for the past 100 years. Mm-hmm. But also, I did go into this with a kind of a puzzle, which is, you know, we all know that giving to other people is, it makes you happy, right? I mean, you give a small thing, you give a small amount of money or a seat on the bus, or you give something big, you give a large amount of money, or you give, in the case of some of the people I wrote about, one of your kidneys. Mm. It makes you feel better than keeping it. So why don't people give more? And I wanted to look into this ambivalence for the answer.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about extreme do-gooders in the world, people who treat suffering strangers as if they were their own family. Why they do what they do and how the world responds. Larissa McFarquhar has written it up in wonderful detail and insight in her new book, Strangers Drowning, Grappling with Impossible Idealism, Drastic Choices, and the Overpowering Urge to Help. She joins us today from New York. You can join us as well. Is this you, a committed big-time do-gooder? How do people respond to that? Have you, do you live with, work with somebody like this? And what's that like? What reception do you see them getting? What do we love about extreme do-gooders? What do we fear? And why do we sometimes hold them at arm's length? What drives this passion, this type of person? Okay, Larissa, lots of response for you online already. And Sam writes to us, isn't this just called empathy? I'm pretty sure we all have it. Give us a story or two that may clarify the difference between ordinary empathy and what you're describing here, Larissa.
Well, I think that the difference is that these sort of people, I don't know if you can describe it as empathy if you are feeling compassion for someone you have never met and can't see. So, for instance, I was interviewing a young man who I would describe, he's not in this book, but I would describe him as one of these do-gooders. And we were talking about suffering in the abstract. He's a philosophy student. Okay. And he was describing a history book he had read which talked about the suffering endured by people in the Middle Ages, you know, nameless peasants in the Middle Ages. And as we were talking, he started to cry. That's what I'm talking about. You know, I don't know if you would call that empathy or not, but it's certainly a very powerful moral emotion, as strong as empathy. And it's something different from the way that most of us feel the need to help. It extends to people who are invisible out there. Now, obviously, he can't help peasants in the Middle Ages, but it's that kind of depth of feeling that led him to want to help people in other countries whom he had never met.
Take us into a story from the book, Strangers Drowning, that would illustrate how this goes, how that depth of feeling goes into action.
Well, there's a couple called Julia Wise and Jeff Kaufman, who I write about, who, you know, Julia always wanted to do good in the world. And initially she thought, as I think many young people do, oh, I should go and work as an aid worker in the third world or a doctor or something like that. And I think that's most people's first impulse, to do something with your hands, face to face with someone in front of you. But then she thought, I'm a college graduate in the United States. If I'm modest, if I'm humble about this, in fact, probably the best thing I can do is not go over there myself, unless I think I'm going to be the world's best aid worker. Probably what I could do best is work here, earn a good salary, and send my money to a good, competent NGO that will hire 4 or 5 aid workers, perhaps, with the money I'm able to send them.
But you're not talking about carving out 4% or something from their earnings.
No, no, no. I mean, well, initially, she and her husband had to figure out her moral drive was so strong that she was in danger of driving herself completely crazy. There's a moment at the beginning of their lives together, she and her husband, where he buys her a candy apple in an orchard, and it costs $4. And afterwards, he told her, I'm going to start donating my salary, too, inspired by your example. And then she realized that $4 that came out of his money could have been donated. And she just broke down and started crying. Now, they both realized this is not going to do anyone any good. This is stupid. We have to figure out a system to form some moral parameters that we can live with for the long haul. So they did. Initially, she was giving away 100% of her salary, and he was giving away 50%. Now they give away 50% of their combined income. And she's a social worker, so she also has that kind of feeling of helping someone right in front of her. But she considers this donation more important than her social work. And since he's a programmer at Google, they combined managed to send quite a lot of money to charities they have researched and determined to do a lot of good. I think last year they donated close to $130,000 between the two of them.
It won't change the world, but it's a lot from two people, and it requires a lot from them in terms of what they don't do, the sacrifices that they, in their case, gladly make.
Yes. Though, as I said, like, part of their achievement is not just the sacrifice, but the careful drawing of the parameters. They had to figure out a system that works for them. So they have, each of them, an allowance per week, which they have to spend on not quite necessary things like candy apples, or the husband has decreed that he will donate a matching amount to the Republican Party. They are not Republicans, in order that they not go insane trying to work out every single purchase in terms of, is it necessary or could I save the life of a child with an anti-malarial bed net for that same amount of money? They know that that's not going to work.
I mean, you've got people who really go into extremes here, you know, doing dumpster diving to eat so that they can save money to do good. Larissa McFarquhar's new book is Strangers Drowning, Grappling with Impossible Idealism, Drastic Choices, and the Overpowering Urge to Help. She's writing about extreme do-gooders with fascination, with admiration in many ways, but also with a very clear eye on the ambivalence that our human societies often bring to their stories. Larissa, stand by in New York. Patrick's calling from Fishersville, Virginia. Patrick, thank you for calling. You're on the air. Hello, Patrick. Are you there, my friend? We may have lost Patrick. Let's go to Alan in Binghamton, New York. Alan, you're on.
Nice to talk with you.
You too. What do you think?
Well, I think for myself and maybe for others, when we can do something to help people, you know, it could be a very small thing. It kind of helps us to step out of ourselves and we look at things differently when we, you know, when we walk away after we've done that. It changes us a little bit, and I think it's for the better.
And what about people who devote everything to altruism, to being, like, full-on do-gooders?
That is amazing. I don't know how they do it, and I think it is altruistic. I think it's just fantastic. I don't know how they do it financially or time-wise, but I admire them and respect them for that, and also respect those who do it a little bit at a time too. It's we all can think about that, and it might make things a little bit better.
Alan, I appreciate your call. Larissa, were you able to spot the point at which ordinary citizens look at extreme do-gooders and say, at a certain point they're saying that's fantastic, and then there comes a point where they say, "Whoa, I'm not so sure about what you're demonstrating now."
Yeah, I think it's actually not just the extremity. It's the type of do-gooding. So there's a kind of person I call in this book a hero who endangers him or herself just as much as a do-gooder, but in a different way. They are spontaneous. So, for instance, somebody who walks by a burning house mm-hmm. and runs in to save someone, that person is endangering his own life far more than someone who donates a kidney. But it's a different kind of action, one that no one has a problem with, because it's done spontaneously by an ordinary person who has a crisis thrust upon him and rises to the occasion, does the noble thing. Whereas somebody who sits back and thinks in cold blood, I am going to save someone's life and I'm going to do it in the following way. I'm going to donate one of my kidneys to somebody I have never met. even though that kidney donor is risking his or her life far less, people find that very weird. You know, when I wrote about people who donate one of their kidneys to a stranger, mm-hmm. and the reactions to them were very complex. They were not, as I thought they would be, uncomplicatedly admiring. People, their family members thought, wait a minute, why are you donating to a stranger? What about me? What if our kids need a kidney? What are you thinking? And their friends just thought it was bizarre, and they thought, well, there's something not only twisted but also maybe extra puffed up and narcissistic about you, that you think you're so great doing such a big thing. And the doctors who were working in the transplant centers were also very suspicious. You know, about something like half the transplant centers in this country will not accept donors who want to donate to a stranger because they suspect there's something crazy about them.
That's just well, you tell the story of Paul Wagner, who goes through that.
Yeah.
But
mm-hmm.
but how did Paul describe to you his motivation? Because, how did he?
Well, this is the thing that people miss. He was excited about it. You know, it was something he wanted to do, and it's something I'm puzzled that is so obscure to people, because here's something, you know, usually when you try to do good, we all know it's incredibly difficult to help other people. It's liable to backfire in a disastrous way.
Can.
You know, donating mm-hmm. to aid agencies is very complicated. Aid often is wasted, or it actually harms the people it's trying to help. We know what a catastrophe the aid to Haiti after the earthquake was. It's very hard to know that you're actually getting done what you want to get done. When you donate a kidney to somebody, you are really close to sure that you're going to enormously help that person. Either you're saving their life or you're transforming their life, because dialysis is a kind of death in life. It's a terrible, terrible existence. And what a feeling, you know? He looked forward to giving his kidney because he thought, what a great act. You know, I talked to somebody else in the course of this book, and he said, you know, I never try to make people feel guilty because that gets you nowhere. What I tell people instead is, if you donate money to, you know, effective charities, think about Oskar Schindler. He saved something like 1,200 lives, I think mm-hmm. it was. Mm-hmm. And we think he's this great hero. Well, here's this opportunity for you. You can save even more lives for not that much money. How exciting is that? What a great opportunity. That's his sales pitch. And I think it's very effective.
Larissa McFarquhar, I want to read at a little bit of length about the ambivalence here, because it gets to priorities, it gets to a sort of framework for living, and even for people who aren't do-gooders, how we think about ourselves, how we think about the world's needs, think about them. She writes, "Ambivalence toward do-gooders also arises out of a deep uncertainty about how a person ought to live. Is it good to try to live as moral a life as possible, a saintly life? Or does a life like that lack some crucial human quality? Is it right to care for strangers at the expense of your own people? Is it good to bind yourself to a severe morality that constricts spontaneity and freedom? Is it possible for a person to hold himself to unforgiving standards without becoming unforgiving? Is it presumptuous, even blasphemous, for a person to imagine that he can transfigure the world, or to believe that it really matters what he does in his life when he's only a tiny flickering speck in a vast universe? Should morality be the highest human court, the one whose ruling overrides all others?" That's quite a paragraph of sentences, Larissa. What do you come to out of that?
Well, you know, part of the reason I wanted to write about these extreme cases is because they really do push at something that's not petty, that's very deep in human life. You know, we can say, oh, we ought to do more. And what we usually mean by that is we shouldn't give $10 to this charity or that charity. We should give $50 if we can possibly afford it. You know, little things like that. Or we should volunteer someplace. But these sort of people test the boundaries of what we think morality ought to demand of us. So, for instance, Baba Amte died a few years ago, was a man who founded a leprosy colony in the middle of the wilderness in India. Mm-hmm. And he moved there with his wife in the late 1940s. And at the time, they had two young boys. I think they were both under the age of two, certainly under the age of three. And they moved out to this place with no food, no water. They built themselves shelters out of sticks and mud. At first, they didn't even have any walls. And they moved there with several dogs to protect them from the wild animals that were roaming nearby, panthers, tigers, mm-hmm. wild boars. One by one, each of those dogs was eaten by the panthers who would come in and snatch them. And their children were not eaten, but they could have been. That's the level of risk we're talking about. And that's where the ambivalence towards do-gooders is not a matter of, you know, I like my stuff, I'm selfish, I'm lazy, I'm conventional. It's not pettiness. It's deep. It's wondering, is that really right to put your family in such danger? Not to mention, of course, the danger of catching leprosy. Now, at this point, we now know that leprosy is, in fact, barely contagious, and most humans are immune to it. But in the late 1940s, they did not know that, and there was no cure. So they were also risking that not only they, but their children would catch what then was a truly terrifying disease.
We're talking with Larissa McFarquhar about extreme do-gooders and the questions they raise for all of us. Jody in Cohasset, Massachusetts. Jody, you're on the air with Larissa.
Hi, Tom. This is actually something that I have battled all of my life, and it's a fascinating topic to me. When I was about 9, I asked my mother if Jewish girls could become nuns, and she sort of smiled and asked me, did I want to become a nun? I said yes, and she asked me why, and I said, because it seemed to me that nuns are the most selfless people on the planet, and they devote their life to doing good. And being an absolutist in my thinking, which is most often not a good thing, I find myself feeling that to be a good person is to be an extreme do-gooder, is to do all the good you possibly can in your life, throughout your life. But my fatal flaw, as I see it, is that I don't have the DNA. I don't have the whatever it takes to make someone an extreme do-gooder. I wish that I did. I flew off to Oklahoma City after the bombing. I do what I can in my little life, but I can't devote my life to doing good. And my question for your guest is, What is the difference? What is that missing piece in me or in others who have such a profound urge to be an extreme gooder, to devote your life to doing good, but who don't for whatever reason? And what's the difference? What makes someone able or willing to devote their life to doing good and others not able?
It's a great question, Jody. And your struggle with it to become the Jewish nun and all the rest is really fascinating backdrop to it. Larissa, what about it?
Well, it's interesting you should bring up Judaism, because one of the questions I was interested in is what difference does religion make, and what difference do different religions make in determining how someone molds their urge to do good? And by tradition, Judaism and Islam are different in that they require a certain amount of donation to charity of their of Jews and Muslims, but they forbid more than a certain amount on the grounds that you are not permitted to impoverish your family. You must take care of your family, and you must not donate so much that you put that at risk, which is interesting because I think other religions such as Christianity or Buddhism or Hinduism have a much greater allowance for a more extreme commitment that would entail sometimes impoverishing a family or even abandoning them altogether.
And yet it doesn't seem religion that decides in the stories you tell. It seems something more personal driving people.
That's true. Well, there's something in some of the people in this book which has to do with their families of origin. And I discovered a theory that taught me a lot called the theory of the parentified child.
Can you hold that theory, Larissa?
Yes,
we're up against the clock here.
Family of origin.
Larissa McFarquhar is with us. Her fascinating new book is Strangers Drowning, Grappling with Impossible Idealism, Drastic Choices, and the Overpowering Urge to Help. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about what you might call extreme do-gooders in the world, people who treat suffering strangers as if they were their own family, go to great, great lengths to help people they might not even know at all why they do what they do and how the world responds to them. Larissa McFarquhar is my guest. Her new book is Strangers Drowning, Grappling with Impossible Idealism, Drastic Choices, and the Overpowering Urge to Help. It's a big exploration of... She doesn't love the term do-gooder, but it's the best she can come up with, and she defines it fairly well as those who really go on deep at considerable sacrifice, though they may not always see it that way, and why they do what they do, and why society, we respond to them as we do. You can join the conversation this hour. What do we love about extreme do-gooders? What do we fear? Why do we sometimes hold them at arm's length? Interesting responses here. Sean says, it takes a special person to adopt kids, especially when they have biological kids of their own. It's hard enough raising your own kids. These people are as close as I believe to saints. But Patty says, the whole business of extreme do-gooders, she says, it's like compulsive gambling, hoarding, self-destructive. Larissa McFarquhar joins us from New York. And Larissa, we were talking about whether there are some common origins here. And you went to family of origin as one potential place to look.
I did. I mean, I went into this project thinking I want to, you know, I felt a little bit on sides. I wanted to defend these people against what I felt were puzzlingly off-base theories about how crazy they were. Something like half the people I spoke to along the way about what I was working on would say, you know, those people, they're mentally ill, right? I mean, similar to the comment you just read.
Mm-hmm.
And I read a lot of psychological literature about altruists. And one theory I came across was this theory I mentioned, the parentified child. The idea is that a child who grows up in a house where there's at least one parent who's just not functioning as a parent, either because he or she is an alcoholic or because he or she has a severe mental illness, mm-hmm. for some reason is not working as a parent at all. And that child may grow up to feel that he needs to fix his family. He needs to take care of everybody. He takes care of his younger siblings. He takes care of his other parent. He tries to do the housework. Maybe he feels that if he's a perfect child and does really well in school, everything will be okay. But he feels that it's his responsibility. And the idea is that such a child may grow up to feel an outsized sense of moral duty, that it's his duty to fix the world, just as when he was a child, he felt it was his duty to fix his family. And when I first read this, I thought, you know, bah, this is yet another psychological theory designed to undermine do-gooders and tell us that they're all nuts, which I did not believe. But then I looked at the people in my book and I thought, it certainly is striking that not all of them by any means, but a large number of them did come from a family like that where one of their parents was either an alcoholic or severely mentally ill. So it may be that that's one origin of this extreme sense of moral duty. On the other hand, I thought, well, okay, so maybe some people grow up to feel an extreme sense of duty because of their bad parent. But then think of another child who grows up in a home with two great parents who instill in this child a sense of responsibility for helping others because they, these two good parents, are believe in the importance of morality and helping others. So these two children grow up with a sense of extreme moral duty. Is one more free or more true than the other? I'm not so sure.
You quote all kinds of people in their ambivalence here. Benjamin Franklin saying, such extreme nicety as I exacted of myself. I guess when he was at that trying to be fully good, might be a kind of foppery in morals, which if it were known would make me ridiculous. So it seems like he kind of decided to change himself a bit there. George Orwell, I mean, Gandhi, you remind us, believed that the seeker after goodness is obliged to forswear close friendships and exclusive loves.
because loyalty may tempt him to wrongdoing or distract from impartial love of all. And George Orwell found that repellent. Orwell wrote, "The essence of being human is that one does not seek perfection, that one is sometimes willing to commit sins for the sake of loyalty." Smart guys with ambivalence here, and yet you end up pointing to what you call some of the forces among do-gooders that are most among the most fundamental, vital, and honorable urges of human life.
It's very deep, the ambivalence towards them. That's what, part of what I'm trying to convey, that it's not just, you know, when we normally talk about, well, why don't people do more good or why don't people give more? Our usual answer is, oh, we're selfish, you know, we're conventional, what have you. And that's, of course, true. But what I wanted to get at is it's also much deeper. George Orwell is pointing to something very deep about Gandhi. Now, I should say that he greatly admired Gandhi. Mm-hmm. He thought he was extremely savvy and he admired his moral nature. He said something, he had a wonderful line, something like, "What a clean smell he leaves behind," as opposed to most historical figures. So he admired him, but he also was repelled by this extremity which led him to treat his family very shabbily in pursuit of his larger goal. And this is a very deep conflict. You know, the question of whether it's right for a person, even someone like Gandhi with an extraordinary an extraordinary cause to promote, is it right for that person to treat their family so badly? But, you know, I don't think it's a simple question. I mean, that's why I talk about wartime, because I think most of us feel that it's bad to abandon your family for the sake of a cause, in part because we feel that we're living in ordinary times. But if you change the context and say we're, our country is at war, or there's a crisis, a hurricane, a tsunami, something enormous has happened, instantly moral expectations of ordinary people of themselves are transformed. All of a sudden, if your country is threatened, it seems perfectly ordinary to abandon your family for the sake of something larger, to go defend your country. In normal times, to expect someone to sacrifice their life for the sake of a stranger seems crazy, zealous, absurd. In wartime, it's, again, totally ordinary. So I think,
when all is at risk.
Exactly, exactly. I think that part of our sense that these do-gooders are strange and crazy stems from a sense that we are living in ordinary times. They don't think we're living in ordinary times. They know that all over the world there are horrible things happening, as horrible as if we were at war. And they feel the same sense of urgency that an ordinary person would feel, you know, if, say, your town were flooded with these refugees in Europe. Now, Europe is feeling that right now. At least some people in Europe are feeling the urgency of these strangers who are literally drowning outside their shores, and the urgency to help them. But, you know, we're far away and we don't feel that same urgency. Do-gooders do.
Maybe part of the appeal of your book and all of this thinking right now is our slow motion emergency of climate change. Mm-hmm. For people who hear that or see that as a clarion call, it is tantamount to war. There's all is at risk. Our former colleague here, Wen Stevenson, is out with a terrific book. It's called "What We're Fighting For Now Is Each Other," and so he's writing about the people drawn into this movement now. And it seems to me to be right along the line you're talking about. But maybe the debate is even more fierce there, because we have this ambivalence about doing this kind of good, and then the clarion call is not obvious to everyone, or some people are in denial.
Well, I think the problem with climate change is that it's so big and so abstract and so not focused on any one person that it's hard, I think, for people to grasp its urgency.
To a point, charities, but then there's a Dead Sea, or there's the coral dying, or there's the whole species vanishing, or, you know.
Yes,
or,
of course. But it's so big. I mean, you know, charities know that when they send out those flyers asking for money, if they say, "Please help 10,000 children who are dying," they're going to get very little response. If they say, "Save these 10 children who are dying," they're going to get more. If they say, "Save this one child whose name is X," then they're going to get a huge response. It seems to be wired into our brains that we respond much more to small crises that we can understand and locate than to big crises, even though those big crises are far more important. And that's why I think this moral imagination, this ability to vividly conjure mm-hmm. the suffering of people you can't see or the potential suffering which will be brought about by climate change is so important. And that's part of what these people can show us. You know, we can't wait for the photograph of the drowning person drowning because climate change has flooded their town. We have to be able to imagine it before it happens. Of course, it's already happening, but before the most gruesome effects start to take place.
Let's go to our listeners, Jesse in Edenton, North Carolina. Jesse, you're on the air.
Yeah, thanks. I'm 25 years old, and a few years ago, I was asked a question that really changed my life. And I was in college, and the question was that, you know, what's a life that's only living for yourself? What's a life that your career and your money and everything, all your time is spent for yourself? And it really changed my life. And after that, I went to the Middle East and in India and some other countries, and I know some other close friends that are serving in these other countries and stuff and just laying down their life and stuff. And
what did you do there, Jesse? Were you doing altruistic work or just traveling? Or
yeah, in the Middle East, I was helping Syrian refugees for about 6 months.
Okay.
India, I just went with a friend and went in the slums and just kind of gave people our time, the most precious commodity we have, you know, and just spent time with them. It's what's a life? I guess that's the comment and the question that really changed my life is, what is our life if our career and our money and everything is spent to further our kingdom, to just, you know.
What is a life if lived just for ourselves? Yeah, we've got it, Jesse. I appreciate your call. Jesse, let me hold that and get one more, if I may. Elaine in New York, Miller Place, New York. Elaine, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Melissa. I donated a kidney to someone in 2002. She wasn't a close friend, but she was a coworker. So I knew her just to say hi in the hall.
Yeah.
And I found out that she was running out of places where they could give her dialysis, and she was going to die. So I said, well, someone's got to step up. You know, why isn't anybody offering her a kidney? And I said, well, maybe I'm the one who's going to do it. So I offered it to her, and we went through the matching process, and we matched. And after the surgery was over and we came back to work, all these people are saying to me, oh, you're a saint, you're a saint. When you die, you're going straight to heaven. Oh, I could never do that. And I thought, this was very little trouble to me, you know. And I said, well, no, I'm not a saint. I'm not going to heaven. I'm an atheist. I'm not a religious person. But I just thought this was, you know, ethically correct. This was a good thing to do.
What do you think sets you apart, Elaine? Many people don't do it. What do you think it is about you that made it logical to you?
I'm not sure. I know that I am a little OCD. I have, I can't stand watching torture or movies where people are supposedly being tortured or anything like that. Mm. I just have a great empathy for people and animals, you know. I don't know. Also, it's when you do something, at least give a kidney, you get all these free tests and you find out that you're a healthy person. And that's a tremendous
thing. So a little something on the side for you, Elaine. I'm glad for that. But it's a big gift, a kidney. Larissa, you described earlier that ambivalence or even suspicion that's in the system when people like Elaine step forward.
It's true, but you know, the kind of person I'm writing about, do-gooders, have the same attitude that she does, which is, what's the big deal? I'm just doing what everyone should. Now, we can think differently. We can think that was an extraordinarily good thing that you did. But, you know, Kimberly Brownwhale, who is a Methodist pastor in Baltimore, whom I write about in the book, she donated one of her kidneys to a stranger, and she thought, you know, why can't you give one of your kidneys if it's sitting around? You know, you got a spare one. And she went through with it and she said, you know, I've had flus that made me feel worse. It was not such a big deal. Now, we can look at her and say, you're actually wrong. That was a great thing to do. But I think what we're missing, and it's not the case with just one act, but like even an extraordinary act like donating a kidney, but it's wrong to think about this kind of life as just a matter of sacrifice, because it also gives tremendous purpose. You know, that's what the young man in the previous call was talking about. He was going abroad to help other people, but he was also doing it for himself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it gave him a sense that he was doing something far more significant and exciting with his life than if he had stayed at home and just worked some job like everybody else he knew. And that's something else, you know. So there's a woman, for instance, in my book called Dorothy Grenada, who had who did many different things with her life. Now she's 83. She spent a long time as an anti-nuclear protester, and she felt that she was contributing to saving the world. Now, that was a great feeling. You know, she was doing it for the world, but she was also doing it for herself. How many of us feel that way?
True, but you don't describe all these people as somehow achieving enlightened state or bliss. I mean, Hector Tobar reads you for the New York Times and says, without exception, McFarquhar's do-gooders are as messed up and conflicted as the rest of us, if not more so.
Yes, no, absolutely. I'm not talking about bliss. I'm talking about a human. They're not weird, saintly, pure figures at all. They're humans just like the rest of us. But, you know, it's a kind of sense of total purpose that I think very few of us are lucky enough to feel. I would liken it to that of an artist or an athlete. Sue Badeau, whom we talked about earlier, the woman who adopted 20 special needs kids, she compares her life to somebody who wants to climb to the top of Everest. And other people will look at that person and think, what is wrong with you? Why do you want to do such a weird thing? You sacrifice so much money, so much ease, so much time with your friends and family to achieve this strange goal. But that's what they want to do. And she said, you know, my life is the same way. I have this goal that I'm reaching for, and that's what gives purpose and meaning to my life, and I want to do it, despite the sacrifices.
More power to them. There will always be plenty who do not. Fascinating, deep journey of discovery here and illumination around this whole realm. Larissa McFarquhar's new book is Strangers Drowning, Grappling with Impossible Idealism, Drastic Choices, and the Overpowering Urge to Help. Larissa, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for joining us as well. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.